Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, Janet, are you on with us?
I'm here.
I'm sorry, we have some kind of technical difficulty here at first. If you want now, if you can just start where we left off, because I had just introduced you, and then there was a problem with the sound again. I need to work on this with the operations of the Blog Talk Radio. So can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and what's been going on with this event that you have been putting on, this historical event?
Sure. We have the we've been organizing the National Day of Freedom and Justice Movement. And what that is where we will have people on the ground in every state peacefully rallying to draw attention and to hopefully force change. We also have four other countries. I did a show the other day in Portugal, so we may have a fifth country on board. And what we're going to do is we've staggered the time so that everybody across the United States and even in other countries will be doing this event live at the same exact time. We're also going to have a ringing of the bells, which is to signify freedom and justice for all our loved ones who are behind the walls. And it's also a chance, an opportunity to honor them and let them know that they're not alone.
I think what you're doing is excellent. It's really, it's amazing. I've noticed it's all over Facebook. It's pretty much gone. It has gone viral, and it's really something that's very, very, very much needed in this country. Actually, it's needed around the world, but it's good that you're starting it in this country, and in others throughout the world, globally, are finding an interest
right.
in it as well.
Yeah, I think it's so amazing that other countries are taking such an interest in what's going on here in the United States in our criminal justice system. And, you know, we have places like, some very poor areas in Africa who, of course, are they're struggling their own struggles every day, but they want to support us. And, you know, for that to be happening, I think that proves even further what we've all been saying for so long, is that there is so much change needed. There's so much injustice going on in our criminal justice system.
I agree. And, you know, as you mentioned Africa, but, you know, as I mentioned before, I think Jan Benning and Marion Jacobs from the Netherlands, Franz Kurz from Germany, Steve Willett from England, all these people from these other countries, actually they're not only advocating for the incarcerated in their countries, but they're also advocating for the incarcerated in this country, which is unbelievable, because when we have people in the Department of Corrections around the country that are abusing and depriving and provoking and harassing and doing all these negative things to prevent these prisoners from being productive, preventing them from being rehabilitated. And we have people from other countries trying to undo what they're doing, which is, it's amazing. This country is looked down upon, it's laughed at from other countries because of the inhumane and chaotic ways they do everything. The recidivism rate in other countries is almost nothing. And we're waiting and expecting somebody from this country, some government officials, to come together and try to do what these other countries are doing. Take their example. But this country, I believe, is too proud. They don't want to admit that they can't do it without the help of people in other countries, or they can't do it without the help of some psychologist for themselves, because they don't have that mentality or compassion or understanding or forgiveness. It's all about vengeance. It's all about retaliation. And unfortunately, it's about greed, because we see what's happening right now with the families of prisoners putting out all this money for these unrealistic phone bills, the emails, whatever it is that these, whatever these prisoners are in need of, and they have to provide for themselves or if they have family members to help them. It's ridiculous.
It is. You know, I think that's one of the biggest problems, is that when prisons in this country became for profit, that's when, you know, we started seeing an influx of people incarcerated. Of course, it all goes back to the war on drugs and things like that as well, back in the 80s. But, you know, even a state facility that's not supposed to be for profit or not owned by a for-profit company, they're making money. You know, like you said, the phone calls, their commissary, you know, all the stuff that the families, if the people inside are lucky enough to have family members or friends who can help them out. But I know it's a huge expense for me, you know, just being able to talk to my son on the phone and make sure that he has something to eat. Yeah.
You know, the sad thing about it is it's not necessary. Sometimes you'll be on the phone and you'll get cut off before the time is up, but you're still paying. And in the holidays, there was a time when you could order packages of, you know, Christmas presents or something. But nowadays, you have to order everything through the Department of Corrections or their contracted agencies. My loved one, my son, will not accept money from me or anyone, and he's been in 24 years. So he's really been living indigently. And yet they keep taking and taking and taking from these prisoners, and it's sad. It's really sad to know that these things are going on. When they go to prison, they become in the custody of the Department of Corrections, and they should be providing everything for them. But when families start sending money to their loved ones, and the Department of Corrections sees all this money coming in, they take advantage of it. And that's when they start charging prisoners for everything. And it's becoming unrealistic that people have to pay this kind of monies when they're already in pain because they lost a loved one to incarceration.
Right, right. And, you know, the facility where my son is, and I don't know of any other state that does this, but I may be wrong, but here in Virginia, you know, even though he is held right now in a very large regional facility of, you know, close to 1,500 incarcerated, they actually charge them. They have to pay a daily fee to be in that facility. Some of the jails are, you know, $1.50 a day, some are $1. But that comes anytime somebody puts money on their books for their commissary. That money will come off first before they have a chance to, you know, buy their deodorant or their soap or whatever else they need.
And that's why prisoners will not accept money from anybody, because when the money is gone to the individual, it gets taken away for any other things, postage and things like that. They, you know, if they can't afford postage, the account's building up every time they use the postage. So if you send money to your loved one, it's taken because of the postage being so high. It's any way, as you say, any way they can get money, any way at all. And I wanted to ask you, Janet, in this rally, when you have this rally, what are some of the issues you're bringing to Washington, if you can let the public know?
Sure. Some of the main issues that we want to address is the mass incarceration. And we believe that the only answer to mass incarceration is mass decarceration. And so what we are doing, we're actually making a direct appeal to the president, as well as every governor of every state, to really take a focus on clemencies, compassionate releases, especially now during the COVID. We also want to address, you know, the reentry process. You know, prison is supposed to be a form of punishment, but also rehabilitation so that when they are released, they can be released as, you know, successful citizens. And unfortunately, when they're thrown into these cages and they're treated like animals and they don't get the proper rehabilitation, the training skills for jobs when they're released, you know, there's so many things involved, then they're failing our people, and therefore they're failing, you know, not just them, they're failing the taxpayers, you know, because ultimately we're footing the bill and they're supposed to be spending this money in a certain way, and it's not happening.
Exactly.
We are so, you know, the inhumane living conditions is a huge concern. I'm sure everybody has seen the pictures and videos coming from Alabama recently, or Georgia. Same thing for Mississippi. You know, this is proof, you know, of what everybody has been saying for so long, and the officials have swept under the rug, and people have this misconception of, you know, they're in jail. Oh, they get three hots and a cot, and they're safe there. They're safe from the COVID, and, you know, it's all misconceived information that they're getting. And so that's another reason for the rally. We want to bring it to the attention of the people, what is actually going on, and we want to force changes.
Exactly. Do you know, I know if the audience hears this, and I hope they will, if people go on the internet and they type in dirty water in Massachusetts prisons, or dirty water in Alabama prisons, or dirty water in New York prisons, they're going to come up with it. There was a place in Massachusetts, one of the prisons, and not only one, there's many in Massachusetts. The water is so dirty, it's brown. It's turning the teeth brown on prisoners. There was a big thing about that a couple of years ago. It was a major issue. And if they type in the internet browser, inhumane conditions in prisons in Massachusetts, Alabama, California, New York, Ohio, wherever, Florida, they're going to come up with a lot of things, because even though they're misrepresented, when they type in these things, they're going to see that there's going to be some prisons that are going to be showing up. When you type in drugs being brought in by prison guards, you know, there's going to be things coming up. So the public can get aware of a lot of this just by typing in whatever issues that we are talking about right now, whatever issues that you're going to be bringing up at this event. They can find a lot of it's going on around the country. And these are the things that people need to do. They need to get more informed, not by listening to what you're saying or what I'm saying or what anyone's saying. If they don't believe it, go on the internet and it'll confirm exactly what Janet Lee is talking about right now.
Right. You know, there's so many resources available to us right now. And you know, the thing is, I think a lot of people are just, they're either not concerned with it unless they have a loved one who is affected by it, or a friend, or they just don't believe that things like this will actually happen in the United States of America. You know, some of these facilities are as bad as third world countries. And it's just, you know, my son was in Mississippi, and he used to tell me how bad things were. And, of course, I knew they were bad, but I had no idea until I started getting pictures and videos from, you know, all different facilities, and not just Mississippi. I get them from all over, and you're right. You know, this is a systematic problem. It is across the board. But people yeah. just aren't aware, or they don't have the drive or the initiative to actually get involved. And so that's what we're hoping, that if we can bring enough attention to what's going on, other people will get involved. And, you know, I've said it time and time again, one person took prayer out of school. What can hundreds of thousands of us do?
Yeah. I think that's where the problem started, when they took the prayer out of schools, I'm sure. But,
I agree.
You know, I just typed in prisoners killed by guards, and it says this was in 2014. When prison guards kill inmates, this was in a Florida prison's massacre. It says they live behind steel locked doors, which is why violence against prisoners by prison guards is such a terrible power. And then it has, this was last year, officials called it a heart attack. Inmates saw a bloody beating. According to the official's account, he was attacked. The guards attacked him and killed him. Florida prison inmate allegedly beaten to death by guards. $3.6 million California prisoner killed by guards. Six prisoners fought off two prison guards, killing one of them. Because these are the things, brutal moments. You know, it says Alabama prisoner Michael Smith dies after incident with guards. This was last year. You know, eight inmates who watched Georgia prison guards kill an inmate. U.S. correctional officers killed. You know, this is what I'm talking about. People are informed by typing these things in.
Right, right. Yeah, there was actually an incident in Indiana State Prison 2.5 weeks ago. The lady, one of the ladies who's going to be hosting an event for us in Indiana, lost her son. He had been beaten and some really bad things done to him, and she just happens to be an RN. And so when she is looking at the report, you know, she has this very good question of how can the guards try to perform CPR or administer Narcan 12 hours after rigor mortis is set in? So that, you know, yeah, there's a lot of cover-ups.
That's awful.
Can you hear me?
Get the titles, and they think that these people are doing what everyone else is expecting them to do, when in fact they're not doing anything, abusing and provoking and doing all the things worse than ever.
Right.
I feel bad for the mother that lost her son that way.
Yeah, she's a super sweet lady, but she literally has been through it with her son. And the sad part is she hasn't seen her son in 2 years. So because they would not allow her to visit, and, you know, there was always an excuse, oh, you know, he's on lockdown, he's this, he's that. So her question is, you know, has this been going on all this time and she didn't even know about it? But if you look at his prison record, he doesn't have a lot of infractions or, you know, behavioral infractions or anything like that.
You know, they'll come up with one. That's the thing. They're doing so well, and they target these prisoners, they'll find a way to make it look like the prisoner was at fault.
Absolutely, absolutely. And another thing that happens, too, we see this a whole lot. The prisons will not say that the death actually occurred at the prison. What happens is when they call the ambulance or whatever, and the inmate is transported to a hospital, that's when they're actually pronounced dead. And so the death, in a sense, they're saying did not happen at a prison. He died in a hospital. So that makes it sound like, you know, maybe there was a medical condition or something else going on, and it keeps their deaths in facilities at a very low number.
Yeah. They get around it somehow, some way. But, you know, I think, again, what you're doing with this event, I think there has to be some positive change coming from this. There has to be, because it has to stop. This can't go on. I understand that there are victims out there in the communities, and there are families of victims who are suffering from whatever damage may have been done. But they also have to realize that a lot of times these people that have committed crimes, a lot of them have had something wrong with them. And I always say that we have this epidemic in this country of mental illnesses and of addictions. And there are some hidden traumas in a lot of these prisoners that went way, way back to their childhood or adolescent years that were never addressed. And they just held it in and held it in. And every time we go through, and we all know, we go through so much pressure and so much stress every day that even for normal people that don't have any psychological or traumatic issues internally, it's difficult. But when you have people that have gone through some serious, serious traumas throughout the years and have not talked about it, and they lose it, and something happens, it's not only the victim's family that are hurting, but it's the family of the offenders. Because the offenders look back at what they've done, they regret it. And a lot of these people that have been in prison for years now have outgrown whatever it was at the time that caused them to do what they did. There were so many in prison that have been in for so many years that they need to be looked at. And like you say, this event that you're having is going to be addressing a lot of these issues. The conditions of the prisons, the rehabilitation process, you know, the type of cases, a lot of these things need to be addressed, a lot of them.
Right, and I think, you know, when they basically took mental health care out of our system altogether, it's very hard, especially for juveniles, to be able to find an adequate source of mental health treatment. And so what's happening is so many people who do have mental illnesses are being locked in the cages. People who do have drug addictions, instead of going to rehab to treat the problem, they're being thrown into prison. And, you know, the thing is, there not only are there people who have psychological issues or addictions in prison, there are so many people in prison on victimless crimes.
Exactly.
You know, the victimless crimes, I think I did a show the other day, and I think they said in like two or three prisons combined, or not prisons, but actual prison settings, that is to include state and federal. I can't remember the exact numbers. It had to be more than two or three, actually. But there were 62,000 people that were in on victimless crimes. A lot of these are conspiracy crimes or what they call ghost drug crimes, or, you know, even my son, you know, and I'm not trying to keep bringing him up, but he got 75 years in Mississippi for breaking and entering into abandoned buildings. There's no victim involved.
He got 75 years for that?
Yes, ma'am. He got 75 years because one of the charges was a conspiracy to break into an abandoned building for the purpose of theft. So, you know, on a conspiracy charge, you get more usually than you do if you actually commit the crime.
You know, 75 years is even harsh for someone that has fired one shot, you know, and a fatal shot. 75 years, I can see for some violent crime like that, but shooting someone or whatever. But for somebody that just breaks into an abandoned, I mean, that may be a 2-year sentence. Years ago, I'm sure it would have been a 2-year sentence. As time
right.
goes on, it seems like the punishment gets worse and worse and worse. And that's why I say it's about retaliation and vengeance, because I can't imagine how these sentences we have people that are serving 3 and 4 life sentences. How many lives can one person have?
Right.
It doesn't
right.
make sense.
Yeah. That's like, you know, one of the cases I've been working on, the guy was sentenced to 1,800 years. How is that, you know, how is that possible? And of course they added on to it with no chance of parole.
These are things that need to be brought to Washington, too, because whoever's coming up with these kind of sentences has to have a psychological problem themselves. You know, the just whoever it is in the courts that are giving these type of sentences have got to have a psychological problem themselves. And instead of putting these people in prison, they need to put them in long-term residential treatment programs, whatever the situation is, the situation.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I believe that people are treated more respectful and more humanely, then they will act accordingly.
Yeah. So what is the status of your son now? How many years has he been in thus far?
Actually, he's out of Mississippi now, thankfully. He was in the infamous Parchment, and he was stabbed a few times there, and then he was transferred to another one where he actually guards. He was in protective custody, and so the guards unlocked his cell to allow others to go in and have access to him, and he was stabbed 17 times.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, my son, he nearly lost his life, and I did not know anything about it. I was not notified for 2 months, you know, because I live 18 hours away. I was calling, oh, he's fine, he's on lockdown, he's in the hole, you know, whatever. So I kept getting these excuses, and finally I received a letter in the mail that said, that told me, you know, hey, Mom, I've been in the hospital. This is what happened. I'm going to have somebody else call you. Is that okay?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that's how I found out about that whole ordeal. But he did get out of Mississippi. We fought very hard, and he was out in 11 years.
Jeez. Is he okay now?
He's not.
There was permanent damage.
He had some punctured lungs, and you know, once you get a pneumothorax like that, you're always susceptible to that happening again. It's happened 3 more times since then. When he first came home, he would not sleep in a bed, and he would not, he had to sleep fully clothed. I mean, jacket, everything. Whatever clothes that he had, he dressed in layers. And he would sleep on the couch with 1 foot literally on the floor and both fists strong. And, you know, he would just, he would wake up in the middle of the night, you know, if I were to walk through the living room or something like that, it would just scare him to death. And so he does have issues. He's dealing with them pretty well. But this is something, you know, when things like this happen to somebody who is a nonviolent person, especially, you know, of course, we don't discriminate. We fight for them all. But he's never had a violent crime. And so now he feels like he has to be constantly looking over his shoulder.
Was he ever
ready
violent?
To fight.
He probably wouldn't admit it if he was, but was he ever violated while he was in there?
He was.
He
was.
You know, it's,
but, you know, his story went back to when he was 12 years old when he got sent to a juvenile prison. And that's the other main issue that we want to address is this school-to-prison pipeline. You know, he was sent to juvenile prison for telling his teacher he was going to kick his butt, except he didn't say butt. So he was charged with communicating threats against a government official. And so he was, you know, I'm not condoning that. It wasn't right. I don't think that he deserved to go to prison over it. But while he was in prison, juvenile, it was documented, and even some things were found on tape where he was hogtied and, you know, water poured on him. He had to sit in his urine and actually defecate on himself, and he was raped by a staff member while being hogtied.
You know, Department of Youth Services is no different than the Department of Corrections, because these kids that are in youth prisons, Well, I don't even know if they still have them because they seem to be putting all these youth in adult prisons now. But the Department of Youth Services has always had issues, and people have always talked about their loved ones as teenagers, as adolescents, going to the Department of Youth Services, being, as you said, being violated, you know, being abused. And so when they come out, the problems are going to be, they will have escalated. So they're going to commit another crime, and they're going to end up in adult prisons. So that's the school to prison pipeline when it all starts there. I don't believe kids should go. I don't think if they're going to have them go into a youth prison, Department of Youth Services, they need to start acting, the adults that are overseeing them need to start acting human, and you need to start acting like adults and doing the right thing instead of making it difficult. No one has an opportunity to better themselves when they're in situations like that. No one. And again, a lot of them go into prisons as victims.
Yes. And the thing is, you know, when you have a child, you know, 10, 12, 14, whatever age, that goes into a facility, or even, you know, a 16-year-old going into an adult facility, it's almost as if their mentality stops at that age. You know, my son's 34 years old now, and thankfully he is just now maturing. I can honestly say he just now finally gets it, you know, that I can't do the things that, you know, stupid choices that didn't affect anybody else, but I can't make these stupid choices and there not be consequences. But when he was released, it was almost as if we had to teach him again how to eat with regular silverware. He was institutionalized. It was really, really bad. Really bad.
Yeah. And that's what happens in prison. They, especially being in a cell, those cells are very small to begin with. They don't have the luxury of walking around the way we can walk around being in our home. And a lot of them are getting, it makes them smaller. It makes their environment, their minds, more focused on a very, very tiny area. Now, a prisoner that was on with us one day last week had talked about voting rights. This thing, and this is something that they don't understand, is that this is a huge country and around the world. And there's a lot of people focusing on different things to resolve these issues. And voting rights are being taken care of by a lot of these other groups and organizations out there. They're fighting hard for them. But we're living in a big environment. They don't see that because they're so used to being in a tight, closed environment, especially with this pandemic, that they feel like everybody has to focus on one issue because there's the issue to them is big, but the environment is small, and it's not. It's just the other way around. The issues are not as big as the people that are fighting for those issues. But being in prison all the time, especially now with this pandemic, they're so closed in that everything around them is small. And that even means the population of individuals out there in the communities fighting for them. It is so huge. You have people now from Portugal, from Africa, from European countries, all over the place, and in this country as well, focusing on several issues. And other people are out there focusing on other things. So these are the things that, like you say, institutionalized. These people can't focus on when they come out. It's like everything is too overwhelming for them because they're starting to see now that it's not as small as they thought it was all those years.
Right. Yeah, they don't have a chance to grow mentally. And, you know, especially with the pandemic, you know, they can't go to even a library, you know, if the facility actually has libraries. And a lot of the facilities right now, or even before the pandemic, are extremely limited, the people behind the walls, to have access to the law libraries. And that's something that they should have the right.
They actually gave a prisoner's law book away to the library, the prison library. They give books away with his name on it. The books that he had for years, that were, he was very attached to those books. And they gave those books away to the prison library. They started giving away his books. They've done this with other prisoners. These prisoners, what little they have, they take from them. And no one, a lawyer, a paralegal went to see a prisoner. And they told the paralegal the prisoner did not want to see anybody. And the prisoner was never notified until later. And when he was told about it, not by the guards, but by the family members, that's when he learned about the paralegal. The paralegal didn't even think to say, that from the prisoner himself. I started thinking about this, and I started realizing if this could happen to one prisoner, how many others have had an opportunity to come before their, or have their lawyers or paralegals come before them, and the person was turned away without notification to the prisoner at all.
Right.
So much is
taken. It's so unfair, and, you know, we hear these stories, and, you know, like we say over and over, unless you've been involved with someone, or, you know, have a friend or a family member who has someone who is in the system, people are just unaware. It's really sad. It really is that people are just thrown into these cages, and it's kind of like they're forgotten about. And, you know, the ones who are lucky enough to have family on the outside who are willing to be their voice for them and who will stand up for them, but look at how many others who don't have anybody. And who knows what happens to these people.
That's the sad thing, because no one knows what's going on with them. If they don't have family member, no one knows what's being done behind closed doors with those prisoners. And even the ones with family are being abused. And we can hear about it in many cases, but some prisoners are afraid to speak out about a lot of these things because of retaliation, and they know that there's no oversight for these administrators. I feel bad for those that are serving life sentences, because they're going through a lot and they have no hope, because they know they have to be there for the rest of their lives and no one cares about them. And what's happening with these prison officials and guards? They know it too.
Right. Yeah. And, it, you know, if someone is so down and they have absolutely no help, no hope, they have nothing to hope for, how is that going to be a healthy environment, not only for that person, but for the people who come in contact with that person?
Yeah.
So it's a trickle-down effect. It really does affect everybody, not only inside the system, but it will continue to the outside. If the people are being abused and not being provided the proper resources to help them reenter in society as successful citizens, then when they are reintegrated with the general public, it's going to affect people they come in contact with too. And it's not always because they're, you know, violent or they just have bad intentions towards people. It's simply because they don't know any other way to act.
Yeah. I wish that we could get people from Norway and other countries to be more involved in coming on and, you know, speaking on their successes and being more active in trying to make changes in the U.S. in that area. I don't know if it would take the governments to work together or somebody from those countries to contact the government here or the penal system, something, but I can't imagine the difference, the comparison, and no one on this end in this country is taking, you know, they're not even taking any action on it. And they know other countries are more successful in their, you know, rehabilitation and release. I don't know.
Yeah, I talked to this lady, wonderful lady. She's from London. And I talk to her regularly. Her husband is actually in prison in the United States. And she says, you know, the prison system there is so different than what it is here. She said, we don't have the policing like you guys have over there. We don't have the crimes like you guys have over there. And again, it's because I believe the people aren't getting the mental health treatment or the rehabilitation for addictions, you know. And it's starting with our children. And there's nothing tangible in place to make a real change for most children when they're at such a vulnerable age and they get entered into this corrupt system.
Yeah.
There's just you know, it's sad because you know what's going to happen. You almost know that, you know, they're going to end up in the adult system.
Yeah. It's crazy. The medical issues in prisons. My son has had a torn rotator cuff for over a year now, and the paralegal was working to help him get some treatment, and they said he had to have physical therapy first. Well, my son was a physical therapist. He went to college 4 years for that, and he knows that that's not working. He needs an MRI. So the people that are treating him now with the physical therapy said that if it doesn't work, they'll start looking at the referring him for the MRI. But when they do that, then again, it's going to be one of those denial situations where it was with the torn meniscus in the knee. It took 2 years to get the operation, and then arthritis set in. So the medical treatment in the prisons is another issue that needs to be addressed. And like you said,
absolutely.
We're paying taxes. You know, this is the sad thing about it, because they don't realize, or they try to pretend they don't know, that we are all, almost 2.5 million families out there of the incarcerated, are still paying taxes. And we're paying taxes for treatment that our loved ones are not getting. And yet the Department of Corrections around the country is getting funding for just that. It's like the food. Who gets the good food? The guards and the officials. The prisoners get the mashed potatoes and rice to fatten them up to make it look like they're being fed. Taxpayers' dollars are being wasted every single day of the week on foolishness.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I don't know how it is in all states. I know right here in Virginia, as soon as someone becomes custody of Department of Corrections, they start getting Medicaid. And so Medicaid should cover their medical costs. However, they still charge a $35 copay to see a medical professional, and they still charge for the prescriptions.
Wow.
Now, if they don't have family members or friends putting money on their books to cover their medical expenses, then they say they don't stop them from getting their medical treatment, but it does happen. They do tell them a lot of times, you know, well, you know, this is going to cost you $35, and you can't get this treatment until this $35 is paid. And even if they do go ahead and provide treatment, they still bill that person. So once that person is released from the facility, they still have a bill, and if they file income taxes, they will take their taxes until that bill is paid.
And if they
so they're getting double paid. The state is getting double payment.
Jeez. These are things that the public, so many people in the communities don't know. But I think also a lot of people just go on with the one thing wrong because they feel like they fit in better. They fit in better if they, you know, if they agree with the people, law enforcement or DOC or whatever it might be. They feel if they agree with them, they're going to be on the good side of them. Not that they really agree with them, but because they're on the good side with them, they're accepting it. They're tolerating it all.
I think it's an easy way out. I really do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people just are not willing to stand up, or, you know, like you said before, there is a real concern for retaliation. And, it may be something as simple as, you know, if I don't agree to this, you know, every time I go somewhere, am I going to be pulled over? Or, you know, there's so many different scenarios that people are concerned with. Yeah.
You just said it. And I think that's why the media will not report so much about the prisons, but they will report if the prisoners or if people go against law enforcement or the DOC. Because the media, most of them are young people too. The media looks at it that way. They're probably getting away with a lot. If they're speeding, they don't have to worry about it because they have their friends in law enforcement. But go against that law enforcement, and like you say, they will get stopped. They will get charged and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a real concern with harassment. Myself, I can tell you, as much as I've been vocal, in the beginning stages, 24 years ago, when I really first started getting extremely vocal and stuff, I was harassed. Not only was I harassed, it was unbelievable. I actually got death threats. I really did when I came out about the abuses and things that were going on in that juvenile facility. You would not believe the stuff that actually went on. But luckily there was an inside police force that was separate from DOC or DJJ that was inside that facility. And so the chief of that police had been there for 24, 25 years. And I would get phone calls, and different members of that police force would say, "Janet, do you have pen and paper?" They wouldn't tell me who they were, but they would give me information. And I would be able then to call my attorney, let them know what was going on. And there was one night we actually had to do an emergency sequester of the dumpster, because I got a phone call that they were throwing files into the dumpster. It was like 3:00 in the morning. And so unless there's somebody that is willing to stand up like this, like the chief of that outside police force, he stood up in a meeting, and he was fired the very next day. He had been there 25 years, and he was fired the very next day. Yeah. Bob Milner, excellent, excellent man. He went on to continue helping because he knew what was going on in those facilities once he started doing the investigations. He learned a lot of things, and so the SBI, and then eventually the FBI got involved. And we were able to get that facility closed down. We got all the children moved. They were sent to the Ruth and Billy Graham Center for Abused Children. And the facility was closed down, and several of the staff members, even as high up as the commissioner of the DJJ, ended up in prison.
Wow. The ones that come up with these death threats, that goes to show you that they are just as criminal-like minded. Because they're making threats against people who are trying to make positive change, not against people that have committed crimes, but people that are just trying to make changes. There was a politician I understood in Massachusetts that had death threats because they were talking about sponsoring a bill to abolish life without parole sentences. So the people that are up here making these death threats, where are they coming from? Where's their mind? They have the mentality of being a murderer. And they're up here making threats against people that are trying to prevent those type of crimes.
Right, right. And life without parole is another huge issue. I don't believe in life without parole. I believe that everyone should have at least the opportunity to go before a parole board.
That's right.
That doesn't mean they're going to get parole. If they're a danger to society, then we do need to look at other options, and they probably should not be released into society. But everyone should at least have that opportunity to plead their case before a parole board.
That's it. I mean, there are terrorists in prison. There are serial killers in prison, mass murderers in prison. But then there's the, like you say, the wrongfully convicted. We're looking at the first-time offenders who may have committed one crime. I know one that fired one shot 27 years ago at a time when he was severely depressed. He gave up a job he had been dreaming of having. He stopped eating, stopped sleeping. He stopped everything. He wouldn't go out with friends. He wouldn't do anything. And he fired one shot. Unfortunately, it was a case of mistaken identity, too. But he ended up getting a life without parole. Never involved with the law prior to that. Never involved with drugs or alcohol. Very shy, vulnerable. And that's where it all began. But these are some of the things that it's just sad. Because I can see keeping prisoners incarcerated that are seriously, seriously violent. But when you come to first-time offenders getting a life without parole, or wrongfully convicted getting a life without parole, that's kind of overkill.
Yes. Yes, especially on the victimless crimes. Again, you know, there's no victim. As far as I'm concerned, if there's no victim, there's no crime.
That's it. Too many people are suffering. And as you say, there's just with your son, the breaking and entering into an empty. I mean, what kind of a, it just doesn't make sense. But Janet,
right.
That was
and,
fun.
You know, it wasn't. I'm
no,
sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say it wasn't just it wasn't the fact that the buildings were vacant; they had literally been abandoned.
Yeah.
For years. Yeah.
I can't even fathom somebody, you know, being sent that kind of sentence or any kind of sentence really. But what I was going to say is we have about 2.5 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you to, once again, give out all the information regarding the event, and also, if you can, let's talk quickly about the guest that you will be bringing on Wednesday, the 26th, I believe it was?
Yeah, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what we're doing, we're having the National Day of Freedom and Justice. And that is when we will have people on the ground throughout the entire United States at the same time, on the same day, and four other countries who will be joining us via Zoom. I am going to be in D.C., and I'm making a direct appeal to the president and to every state governor to look at granting more clemencies and compassionate releases. I think, you know, the mass incarceration is our big issue, and the only way that can be addressed is through mass decarceration. So if anybody's interested, let me know. You can go on the National Day of Freedom and Justice page. It's on Facebook. You can also go to our website, which is freedomandjustice.info. If there's not a location in your state or in your area and you would be interested in hosting, we still have time to set that up, and we want to get as many people on board. We need to support our people. We have to be the voice of the voiceless. We have to put a stop to this nonsense. And then next, Wednesday the 26th, we will have Tina Church, who is a world-renowned private investigator. She does post-conviction, and she has been a very, very strong advocate in the criminal justice reform. She has a nonprofit called TOVA, which is the Other Victims Advocacy Group, and what they do is they assist people from the time of arrest. They will assist not only the person who has been arrested, but their family. Because people don't realize not only the person behind the bars are affected, their families are affected. When we have a loved one that goes to prison, we go to prison with them. And so she helps them every step of the way. If it's, you know, setting up motel rooms for them so that they can come and be with their family members when they go to court. She actually has, she raises money, and she is actually paid for out of her own pocket to cover funeral expenses for people who have been executed. And so I think it's important to realize there are other victims. It's not always, you know, someone who has been hurt by a violent crime. And, of course, we reach out to them, too. But it's also the victims, the family members who are victims. And so she's a great lady, very interesting to talk to.
I want to thank you so much, Jana, for being on with us. You have been a blessing, and I wish I know the event is going to be successful because you have put a lot of effort into getting this thing off the ground. So I thank you so much, and we will have you back on after. We will talk to you on the 26th and have you on back after this event is over to tell everyone how it went, which I'm sure we're going to be seeing on television. But thank you so, so much, and I wish you well.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Thank you, Jana. You take care. And we are now signing off, everyone, and I hope that you will go to Jana's website and check it out, and hopefully you will also be involved. We need you. Thank you so much, and we are now out. Thank you.